Don't move a muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello and welcome to Potrifius Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I am one of your hosts, Joe.
And I'm Cassie.
And today we are reading, or we are looking at chapter 6 of The Chamber of Secrets, Gilderoy Lockhart.
We also read it today.
Well, we read it today, but we're not reading it for you here now.
Could you imagine if this podcast... Actually, I can't imagine if this podcast was just us reading the Harry Potter books, because that would be illegal.
Yeah, I feel like J.K. Rowling wouldn't be happy about us taking some money from her audiobooks.
Frankly, I don't care about whether J.K. Rowling is happy anymore, but yeah, anyway. But
her legal team might be an issue.
I care about my happiness, and being targeted by one of the richest women alive would probably impact my happiness.
Probably.
Yeah. Also, wouldn't be the first time she went after a fan project. Anyway, welcome to Potrifius Totalis.
Yes. We're starting on a high note.
Yep.
It's only gonna go down from here, I
just
think.
Just like the public opinion of J.K. Rowling. Okay, let's do the chapter summary.
Yes. This week is Cassie's turn to do the chapter summary.
It is. Do you have a timer ready?
No, I do not.
I'm sure you totally forgot.
Yes.
We challenge ourselves for all of our new listeners who, for some reason, are jumping in on the sixth episode of Chamber of Secrets. We challenge ourselves to do the chapter summary.
Some real dude. If this is the most current episode and you're like, well, let's see how they are now. Let's see if it's going to be worth it to catch up. I'm sorry you just got really insulted by Cassie over here.
You'll have to reevaluate my role on the podcast.
There's a reason I took over hosting.
Oh, that's funny. Joe is getting the timer ready.
The
for
timer
30
has
seconds.
Been ready.
Oh, God, you can't start it yet. Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Bye.
I hate that you don't count me in. Okay. It's the first day of classes at Hogwarts, and the kids are having a pretty bad day. Ron gets a howler from Mrs. Weasley, and his broken wand causes issues in class, and Harry keeps getting lectured about fame by Gilderoy Lockhart. In Herbology, they repot mandrakes, and Lockhart bungles his first Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson.
19 seconds.
Heck yeah.
I appreciate you censoring yourself, kind of.
Yes. I have done that repeatedly on several episodes. A nice hesitant heck yeah. Okay, so that is what happens in this chapter.
Yes, that's pretty good, and we're done. That's what happened.
Bye. This was a 3-minute episode. It makes up for our last few like hour and 15s.
I don't think the last one was as long. Was it?
Yeah, it was.
We got a little carried away.
Yeah,
it was our first guest. We were very excited to have Zoe.
We were excited to talk to someone other than each other.
Yes.
We've been trapped in the house for a few days. It's snowing, or it did snow, and it's going to snow more. We spend too much time in each other's company. Okay, let's talk about Harry Potter. Harry Potter is the star of this book.
He's also an up-and-coming star in the viewpoint of Gilderoy Lockhart, who is giving him lots of advice throughout the chapter about how to become more famous and how to act as he currently is.
Right. And I think I forgot before this chapter how much this book is about fame. I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about fame in this book. I don't think, like, when I think of the overarching themes in Chamber of Secrets, I think of some other stuff that's in later chapters, predominantly the, like, mudblood stuff and the stuff about, like, prejudice and that sort of thing. And the past kind of looming over the future. But in this chapter, I think fame is like the big thing happening here. And I think Rowling is drawing this contrast between the people who kind of seek fame and revel in it and always want more, i.e. Gilderoy, and the people who kind of reluctantly have to live with it, Harry.
Yeah.
And I think part of that might be that it's the circumstances that sort of change things, that Harry's fame is because a really horrible thing happened to him, whereas Gilderoy's fame is like, I did all these incredible things. Don't you want to know more about it?
Yeah, I wrote a bunch of books. I'm a famous author.
Yeah.
Come swoon over me.
Yeah. And whereas Harry's fame, it's like if somebody brings up his incredible accomplishment, it's tinged by like, oh, and your parents died that night and now you're an orphan. so it's a very different circumstance that leads to their fame, and that obviously explains a lot about why they react to their fame differently, because they're just like Harry's disposition as a person did not lead him to seek out fame. Mm-hmm. And since he's entered the magical world, he's kind of just tried to be like a normal person as much as he can. But in this chapter, I think Rowling is kind of encouraging us to be skeptical of people who want notoriety. Again, without giving up like too much away, it's hard to talk about. So maybe this will be an evolving conversation that we have. But I think
Gilderoy Lockhart is seen giving advice to multiple people
who do not want it,
who do not want it in any way whatsoever. And it doesn't seem helpful either. Like Professor Sprout comes back when we see her first in this chapter. She's coming back from bandaging up the Whomping Willow. Mm-hmm. And Gilderoy Lockhart is next to her, completely clean, clearly hadn't done anything while she's all bandaged up and covered in dirt. And he's saying, oh, I was just giving Professor Sprout tips. I was telling her how to do her job correctly. But don't let that seem like I know more than her, because she is your herbology professor.
And I know you hate it when I use this word, but it is the dictionary definition of mansplaining, of like inserting yourself into a conversation where the other person is much more qualified and informed than you and being like, oh, but actually, this is how you do it.
Yes, I agree completely. I agree completely.
And it's such an annoying thing that Gilderoy does, amongst a lot of other annoying things that he does in this chapter. And I have to wonder, because it seems like a lot of Rowling's public figures in these books are either reluctantly famous, like Harry and I would argue kind of Dumbledore too, or people who are like, I want my name out there. I want people to care about me. And there are people who do a lot of damage with that, like Voldemort seeking power and wanting to be this powerful figure and making people afraid of his name. But there are also people like Lockhart who revel in it and really, really want their name out there and want people to know about them and appreciate them.
Yes.
And I think in a way she's kind of lumping them together in that sense, even if Lockhart isn't outright a villain who kills people.
Yeah, I could see the comparison, I guess, for this first introductory chapter of like really getting to know him. I don't know if that's a step too far.
I think, though, with this chapter, she's just encouraging us to be wary of him.
Yes.
To not trust people that want to insert themselves where they don't belong, and to not trust people who want to be famous.
Yeah. And we see that Harry already doesn't trust him at all.
No.
And already wants nothing to do with him.
Yeah. And he seems to be everywhere. Lockhart, like, he seems to find Harry at like the worst moments in this chapter.
He seems to just be following Harry.
Yeah, which is disturbing, because doesn't he have classes to teach?
You would think he has at least some.
Yeah,
but he is teaching the second years in the afternoon, and we don't know anyone else's schedule.
This might be another Hogwarts math thing where like there are 7 grades of students.
And presumably they're going to like each class multiple times a week.
Yeah. Maybe not every day, but multiple times a week for sure. So him not seeming to have any classes throughout the day is a little disturbing.
But I could also see him just shirking his responsibilities entirely.
Not hosting class on the first day feels like a big shirk.
Well, if we're going to jump to when he does host class and we see it happen.
I don't know if we're there yet.
No.
Are you
saying he shirks the responsibility of like cleaning up after himself?
He does give a test.
He gives a quiz about himself. And I would believe, considering it took a half hour for them to take it, I would believe that he was not in the room for
that half hour. Oh, maybe he left. Oh, okay.
Here's the test. I'll be back. And I'll see you later.
Goes to give somebody advice that they don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the test was
Dumbledore needs help being the headmaster.
All right. But let's rewind a little bit, because we have a whole chapter to talk about before we get there. So Hermione is reading Lockhart's book Voyages with Vampires in the beginning of this chapter. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked about this a little bit in the Flourish and Blots chapter, but Lockhart's book titles sound like Magic Treehouse titles. I don't know if you know Magic Treehouse.
I do. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. They sound like magic,
but also like titles. Any kind of adventure book or like a romance novel.
Yes. Book titles do lean heavily on alliteration, but Magic Treehouse specifically has titles like, because I looked it up, Knights with Ninjas. That sounds like a Lockhart book title.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It just, it again gives this kind of like pulpy nature to Lockhart's writing.
Yeah, this is less informative, more a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas people kind of try to pose it as an informative thing. Like Molly, when she's sending the boys off to deal with the garden gnome, she's like, let's see what Lockhart has to say about this.
Yes, here's advice from him.
When that doesn't seem like the type of books that these are.
Well, that's what he's playing them as.
Yeah. Again, it's that kind of veneer that we're already seeing developed with his character, that like there's an idea that he has in his head of who he is and what his books are. And then there's the reality of it. And it's kind of surprising to me that Hermione would not be cognizant of that, because she is such a reader.
Well, I imagine he is a good writer. So he's taking this information, making a story out of it.
That's true.
It's clearly, he's not pulling these things out of thin air. He's teaching classes about this. He's using these books, but also people have read them and would have called him out if these were just, well, that's not how werewolves work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like part of it might just be that nobody really knows better. Like if he banished the band in Banshee, not that many people have encountered banshees to be able to say like, this doesn't seem accurate. And I think also you can make the argument too that Hermione is very protective of authority figures. So somebody who is posed to her as like one of the greatest writers in the magical world, I could see her being maybe a little blind to.
For the fact that she gets so much of her information straight from textbooks.
Yeah.
This is the book that her magic school told her to read this book. So this is a correct book.
Yeah.
These are facts.
Yeah. I mean, who would just go and type lies and put them in a book and not fact check things?
Yeah.
We've definitely never fallen victim to trusting things that a book tells us. Okay. Anyway, yeah, but that's obviously an evolving conversation that we'll be having, but we have reason to have doubts about Lockhart in this chapter.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, let's start a little closer to the, well, not
that
start.
That happens at the beginning. Hermione reads Voyages with Vampires. Yes. At the very beginning. That was me rewinding to the beginning.
Oh, okay. She does continue to read it throughout the chapter.
Yes.
They like continue to mention that. She also, we see, well, Ron sees her schedule, mm-hmm. and there are hearts all around Lockhart's classes.
Which is troubling.
She's 12. It's not troubling.
When I read that, I typed a note that was like, is it normal for little kids to have crushes on grown adults?
Yes.
Maybe I wasn't a normal kid.
You're still not normal, so.
Because, like, altogether, I don't know that I've totally understood celebrity crushes.
I mean, think about like a boy band. None of those preteens are thinking like, oh, it's a good thing they're my age. Oh,
okay. Well, yeah. Yeah, I guess now when I think of like Leonardo DiCaprio and like the Jonas Brothers, there are young girls who have crushes on them. I'm thinking of that picture of the girl in that really terrible outfit. And it's like, this is the outfit that I wore to a Jonas Brothers concert that I thought was going to make Joe Jonas like propose to me. But yeah, so I guess it is normal. It just feels weird to me.
Yeah, but he's the closest thing we've really seen to a celebrity in the wizarding world.
Yeah. Yeah. Leave it to Hermione to like for her celebrity crush to be a author.
That's fair. That's very Hermione.
Yeah. I guess there aren't really like movies in the wizarding world, at least that I know about. And
yeah, not that
about.
We're told of.
Yeah.
And the only band I remember is like the
Weird Sisters.
The Weird Sisters.
Yeah. Which doesn't seem very Hermione. I don't think Hermione likes rock and roll.
You never know.
Yeah. So that is, it was kind of weird that she had drawn hearts all around it.
I think it's appropriate. Oh, maybe not appropriate, but I think it's in character and for a 12-year-old girl.
Yeah, I guess part of the thing, too, is that I self-associate so much with Hermione that I'm just like, well, I didn't do that at 12, so why is Hermione doing it? Which is perhaps I need to separate myself a little bit.
Getting defensive.
Yeah. Yeah. Why can't she just have crushes on Brock from Pokemon? Because that's what I was doing when I was 12.
Yes, the age appropriate Brock from Pokemon.
Well, Brock was only like 16.
Was he supposed to be 16?
I think so. Any older and it would be mad creepy that he was traveling around with Ash and Misty.
He was like a gym leader.
I mean, I guess his dad walked out on him. Yeah. And Misty's sisters are probably not that much older than her.
I don't know. We can't get into this right now.
Welcome to our Pokemon podcast, Poketrificus Totalus. We're going to talk about a lot of Pokemon in this chapter because Justin Finch-Fletchley is also introduced. But anyway, Ron gets a Howler. We have not talked about that yet at all. Like 15 minutes into this podcast, and that's the first thing that happens.
Well, we do see voyages with vampires beforehand.
Okay,
so.
Whatever. Ron gets a Howler, which is an angry letter.
Howler. Nobody but Neville and Ron seem to know what it is when it first arrives, which, by the way, when it arrives, Errol is sent with it, and Errol crashes into Hermione's milk jug, and I don't know how big a jug of milk should be, but the entire owl fits in it.
How much milk is Hermione drinking?
I don't know. Well, not as much as she planned to because there's an owl in it now.
The trading card for a Howler has Errol on it, and he looks so like weather beaten. And it's very upsetting. I'll have to show it to you later. But it's very entertaining.
Let me see if I can find where Errol shows up. Let's see. A big lumpy package bounced off Neville's head, and a second later, something large and gray fell into Hermione's jug, spraying them with milk and feathers. That's Errol.
Well, that doesn't mean the whole owl fell into the jug.
Errol, said Ron, pulling the bedraggled owl out by the feet.
Oh.
Errol slumped unconscious onto the table, his legs in the air.
Like, how big are owls?
It varies drastically. I believe last time we spoke about Errol, we said she thought he was a great horned owl.
Sure. But I mean, like, you know,
which
how
is a big owl.
Oh, okay. I don't know owl sizes, but you know how like you see a dog and then you see a dog when it's wet and the dog looks smaller.
Yes. Owls are puffy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whatever. I don't know anything about animals.
And you see a dog when it's wet.
Okay. So Ron gets the Howler, and Neville and Ron both know what it is. Ron is just petrified, and he's sitting there frozen. And Neville's like, just open it, man. Like, it's going to be a lot worse if
you
don't.
It'll be worse if you don't. It is already steaming.
Yeah. And
While it's in Errol's beak still.
Neville says he has gotten one from his grandmother before, which it does present a continuity error that, frankly, I don't really care about. Of like, wouldn't we have heard the Howler if Neville had gotten it, like, last year?
Well, we don't necessarily see every breakfast that they have. There are plenty of time jumps.
It'd be notable.
But it depends what it's about. Because knowing Neville, it was like, oh, you forgot this thing again. I asked you specifically not to forget this. Or you did terribly on your exams.
I was about to ask, what did Neville do to deserve a Howler? But I'm thinking now he did get detention for sneaking out at night.
Yes, that would also be a very reasonable.
Yeah, so fair. But the Howler yells, it's from Molly, and it yells at Ron for stealing the car. And
it is Molly's voice 100 times louder.
Yes. I want to know about the process of creating a Howler.
You yell into an envelope.
Yeah. Like, do you have to do it or do you just magic it with the things you want to say and it takes your voice? Like, I'm so interested.
I think you yell into an envelope. That's my guess.
I like to imagine that Molly had to like get the special paper that you need to make a Howler and like sit down really calmly and then just like turn it on and be like, how dare you? Something about that entertains me. It also entertains me.
Going to the store.
Yeah.
Buying one.
Calmly
driving home. Or maybe she probably.
She definitely didn't drive home.
Very true.
I think she probably has a stockpile of these knowing who her other children are.
Yeah. There's a good chance that Fred and George have gotten Howlers before.
I think that's why Ron knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I do also like the idea of somebody being like, I am so mad right now. I need to send a letter. Something about like old styles of communication like that really entertained me, that like people would sit down and write a nasty letter to someone and like go to the post office and mail it.
Oh, yeah.
It just seems like so much effort. Like now we just send mean texts. I don't send mean texts, but other people do.
Okay.
And maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's why people are such jerks on the internet. But yeah, Ron gets a howler.
Ron gets a howler. And the first thing Hermione says is, well, I don't know what you expected, but.
Oh, she's the worst. Hermione is a cop.
Yeah.
At least 12-year-old Hermione is kind of a cop.
Her reaction to her friend being embarrassed and yelled at in front of the whole school is, I told you so, when clearly she didn't tell him so.
And then there's
nobody could have foreseen this and told him not to.
There's a line in like the next paragraph where it's like Hermione felt that they'd gotten their necessary punishment, and so now she's friendly with them again.
Yes.
She was mad at them before, but she's like, you know, Mrs. Weasley took care of it for me.
Like I was gonna be pouty with him for a couple of days to make up for it, but thankfully Mrs. Weasley took care of it for me. So I can be all right to him now.
And now, in reaction to the howler scene, I was going to ask you if your parents had ever yelled at you in front of your friends, but I'm not sure if your parents have ever yelled at you, period.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I can't imagine your parents yelling at you.
Okay. I mean, they're appropriate in public.
Okay.
But yeah, they've definitely yelled at me.
Okay. In front of your friends?
I don't think so. Like I said, they're like very proper in public.
Okay.
So... I don't, not that I remember at least.
Okay.
And I feel like that's something I would remember.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's horribly embarrassing.
But yeah, I'm definitely like, oh, my friends are gone and now it's time. Yeah.
Okay. That's fair. I'm pretty sure my mom has yelled at me when you've been in the room or something. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And half the time it's like about nothing.
Yeah. Thanks, Mom. Anyway. They go to Herbology. They have double Herbology in the morning, and they are repotting mandrakes in Herbology in Greenhouse 3, which they're really excited about because Greenhouse 3 has the like
the dangerous plants.
Yeah.
Which the danger level is just calmly pointed out as after saying, all right, put on your headphones, make sure they're really tight. You're not going to be able to hear a thing. Here, watch me do this. After she does it, has them take off their headphones. She says, if you heard that, that would have killed you.
Well, it's the babies. So yes, the babies won't kill you.
The babies won't kill you. But it's like, mandrake screams would kill you.
I mean, probably because if she had prefaced the lesson with that, there would have been a panic.
Maybe.
Yeah. Let's talk about mandrakes a little bit. Hermione gives us some information on them at Professor Sprout's prompting. But to talk broadly about mandrakes, Hermione does cite the Latin name for mandrakes, Mandragora, which means man-shaped dragon, which is interesting.
Okay.
The actual plant is human-shaped, which...
Baby-shaped, from what we see, but they are sure. The young ones.
They're the real plant. A mandrake is a real plant. The real plant is not like a fat baby like they are in Harry Potter, but they are like they have little sprouts that are like arms and then a little legs. And yeah, if you look up a picture, and I'll put a picture in the show notes of a mandrake, it is like vaguely human shaped, which is where we get a lot of the folklore.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. So the mandrake root in the real world can make you sleepy. And so the ancient Greeks used it as an anesthetic. They would also steep the roots in wine or vinegar to make an aphrodisiac. The Hebrews believed that it could induce conception. In the Bible, in Genesis, Rachel, who's the wife of Jacob, eats one and then is suddenly able to conceive Joseph.
Okay.
In the Middle Ages, based off this biblical story, folks struggling to conceive would sleep with mandrake roots under their pillow to help them. And some also believe that mandrake roots were good luck charms and carry them around with them, believing that they would bring wealth and the power to control destinies. Obviously, the church had some problems with the latter part of that. So the church did not look favorably upon that practice. And Joan of Arc was accused of carrying a mandrake root around at her trial.
Accused of carrying a mandrake root around.
they weren't super heavy at that time on like evidence in court. So mm-hmm. I don't know that they actually checked.
I saw her once with a little human shaped stick.
But broadly, part of what they were accusing Joan of Arc of was that she was claiming that God was speaking to her. And that was seen as circumventing the church because God only speaks to like priests and stuff. And so that was part of her crimes. So her also being accused of carrying around something that would give her power to control destinies would also be a problem because she's putting herself above holy figures. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's kind of significant with the trial. She was accused of a lot of other things and there were other reasons that people were upset with her. But that's as much as is relevant to Harry Potter, at least right now. Rowling's portrayal of mandrakes borrows from kind of the folklore and understanding of mandrakes that we get from like legends, which there are negative things about it. The Deadly Cry is something that exists outside of the Harry Potter books. It is in legends said to be deadly when you pull it out of the roots out of the ground. I mean, it's supposed to produce a cry that will kill you. Mm-hmm. So what people would do is tie a rope to the like top of the plant and then attach the rope to like a dog or something and then call the dog so that that would pull the root up. And so they wouldn't have to be near it to hear the cry.
Oh, okay. Were they just assuming the cry would stop by the time the dog got to them?
I don't know. I'm not sure there's logic associated with this. They also believe that mandrakes were like born of the blood of hanged people, which is weird. And they were generally associated with magic and witchcraft.
I guess if they were hanging witches.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I read a lot of articles about mandrakes today. Shakespeare references mandrakes 4 times that I could find. Falstaff uses it as an insult and then references the kind of aphrodisiac nature of it in Henry IV Part 2, which I think I've read. The Earl of Suffolk references the cry of the mandrake, like by name. I think he says the groans in Henry VI Part 2. And Juliet references them in Romeo and Juliet, the mandrake cries.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of everything interesting about mandrakes we can talk about up to this point.
Yeah, there's a lot of history behind mandrakes. Mm-hmm. And in Harry Potter specifically, we know the cries are can kill you if they're young. They are
if they're matured. Yeah. Young ones.
If
will
they're
just
young,
knock you out.
They will knock you out was what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. And they are used in a lot of healing potions.
Yes, which I think, again, kind of connects to the Greeks using it as an anesthetic. Obviously, the knocking out part of it, but also the idea that it's used in for like medicinal purposes. Mandrake roots also fell out of favor as for use as an anesthetic because sometimes people would accidentally put the patient in comas if they gave them like too much mandrake root or they didn't like prepare it properly. I'm not too sure about the process exactly, but yeah. But again, I bring this up because it's another example of how Rowling is borrowing a lot from folklore and legend in building out the magical world.
I just thought it was significant that Professor Sprout specifically says they're in most antidotes. Mm-hmm. So like this dangerous process is done all the time to make any kind of medicine, like to cure magical ailments.
Well, she's got this little factory of 12-year-olds that she has processed them for.
Yeah,
her,
I wonder if every second year class deals with mandrakes like she just is producing them constantly.
I mean, they do seem to need a lot of healing potions at Hogwarts. So we also meet Justin Finch Fletchley in this chapter. He is at the herbology lesson and he gets named. Harry's like he recognizes him by sight, but he never knew his name or talked to him before this. But Justin mm-hmm. is in Harry's year and he is in Hufflepuff.
Is this one of the first Hufflepuffs that Harry interacts with?
That we know about?
Yeah, like
yeah,
in
I
book,
think so.
Last year, I
besides
don't think he,
Professor Sprout.
Yeah. In book, I don't think he speaks out loud to.
I don't know that anybody's name. What house is Susan Bones in?
I don't know. I can look that up.
She's named.
We do hear the name,
but
of
I don't think he
of,
like talks.
Yeah,
to,
he doesn't talk to
yeah.
Them, but we yeah. hear like a bunch
and
of
we hear names
get
at the sorting.
Off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I definitely think this is Harry's like first interaction in the books that we know about with a Hufflepuff.
Susan Bones is a Hufflepuff.
Okay.
I feel like she was in this scene in the movie.
The actress. Yeah, in the movie they put her in this scene.
Well, this was with the Hufflepuff, so it makes sense.
Well, there's issues with continuity with the actors and actresses used as like the Hogwarts students extras in the movies. The first and the second movie, though, are pretty consistent about like reusing the kids. to do a little background on Justin, there's not a ton to say about him, but he does mention Eton, which is a very prestigious school in England. Like, it's known for, like, prime ministers go to Eton. I'm pretty sure I'm saying it correctly. I think James Bond went there, if that gives you an idea of how prestigious.
This is a real...
Yes, Eton is a real school. He is
a Muggle-born. Because James Bond is a real person.
Yes. he is a Muggle-born. And so he's saying that, like, his mom will hopefully... He's saying that, like, my name was down for Eton, but I went here instead. And my mom was kind of skeptical about it. But now that she's reading Lockhart's books, I think she's going to realize, like, how great it will be to have a wizard around. Mm-hmm. But the Eton thing also gives us some background on Justin's character, that, like, he must be pretty well off if his name is on the list for it. And also the way he speaks, you can kind of tell that he's supposed to be like an upper class character. Like, I think he calls Harry sport or chap or something like that. Even if he doesn't like explicitly say that, he has that kind of affectation.
Brave chap.
Yeah. So to give
but
a little.
That just sounds, I don't know very much about.
That's a very England, upper class way of speaking.
Okay.
I mean, people can use the word chap otherwise, but like.
There's no tax for it.
But like mate would probably be like a lower class version of that, at least
to
comparatively.
Speak about a professor, though.
Maybe not. Okay. I thought I was thinking that Justin called Harry chap, but that along with the Eton mention and some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, we're led to think that Justin is probably pretty mm-hmm. well off.
One thing that stood out was you mentioned that he said his mom is coming around, but in that exact same line, he says, I think she's begun to see how useful it'll be to have a fully trained wizard in the family. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if like there are other wizards that like his mom was more stern with and was like, well, no, you're going to go to Eton. Like, you don't need to learn magic.
He's Muggle-born.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have any siblings that also have magic.
Oh, that's a good point. I don't think he has siblings, but that's fun to speculate about. I thought the suggestion there was more that she recognized that he was magical, but still wanted to send him to Eton, like didn't want to train the magic in him. Mm-hmm. And he's saying like, well, yeah, once I have 7 years of Hogwarts, she's realizing how much more useful that'll be than somebody with like wild, uncontrolled magic.
That's yeah. Either way, yours makes more sense. But that was the first thought of like, oh, okay. A fully trained wizard versus like, well, your sister's doing just OK.
I don't think he has siblings that are mentioned, but sure. Why not? You can write the fan fiction about Justin Finch Fletchley's sister or whatever. Anyway, to talk a little bit about his name, I'm going to read directly from the Harry Potter lexicon etymology section on him because I think it's well done. The hyphenated surname is indicative of the upper class status of Justin's family. In British tradition, a double surname is heritable and mostly taken in order to preserve a family name which would have become extinct due to the absence of male descendants bearing the name connected to the inheritance of a family estate. It's a little differently charged here in America because inheritance was different in America. I'm not going to say that it was fine, like you didn't need to preserve a family name or anything like that. But there's less of a class system around like old family names and old money in America. And hyphenated surnames here are for different reasons. Usually when it's more popular now due to women wanting to like preserve their actual name, but still have a married name and not just mm-hmm. erase their identity once they get married.
It's that or having, you know, even if you don't change your name, your child has both names.
That and then also it can be used for professional purposes. Like if you are like a published author under one name and then you get married, you don't want to lose like that.
The notoriety. Recognition.
Yeah. Yeah. But according to this, at least, it works differently in England, or it has at least different associations and a different history behind it.
At least when this was written. Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah. I'm saying that like this might be the historical reason that they've used hyphenated surnames. But mm-hmm. in modern times, it's for similar reasons to how we do it here in America.
Yeah.
But anyway, Justin's first name is from Latin, meaning just or fair. That's not anything revelatory, but I'm reading the section. Finch is a small seed-eating bird, such as sparrow or goldfinch, and they connect it to the last name of the family in To Kill a Mockingbird, specifically Atticus, who is Scout's father and a lawyer in To Kill a Mockingbird. And To Kill a Mockingbird is a lot about profiling and prejudice, which are some themes that I think we'll see popping mm-hmm. up in Chamber of Secrets. So I thought that was a good connection. even if it might not be intended.
Yeah, it works still.
Yeah, it absolutely works. And then fletch means to make arrows, and usually feathers are attached to them to help them fly in the air, such as finch feathers.
I was thinking like a fletchling. Isn't that like a
small
bird?
Yeah.
So a finch, a small bird, and a fletchling being like a young bird.
Yeah. To make this conversation a lot less intelligent and to bring back the Pokemon references, there is a Pokemon called Fletchling, I think its name is, and it's a little fire bird. And I caught one in that Pokemon game and named it Justin after Justin Finch Fletchley. And then in a later Pokemon game, I wanted that Pokemon again, so I traded it up and named him Justin too.
Fletchling is the name of the Pokemon. Fletchling is not the name of the young bird.
I'm pretty sure a fletchling is a young bird.
Fledgling, I think.
Fledgling, okay.
Yeah.
You're confusing it with Pokemon. It wouldn't be the first time that I confused real words with the names of Pokemon, so.
Yeah. Fledgling.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. But yeah, that's some interesting stuff for Justin. He is going to appear again in this book.
Yeah, so that's all we need to know about Justin, the only Hufflepuff that matters, apparently.
There are others that are going to be named in this book.
Yes, but yeah, this chapter so far only matters.
So after Herbology, the kids go to Transfiguration class, where they're doing stuff with a beetle. And
Harry says some really, or thinks at least, some really relatable stuff of like, over the summer, he forgot everything, which is a very classic thing.
I don't feel like I ever experienced this.
I'm sure you did mildly educational things over the summer.
Yeah, though. I did. I was a little nerd. I would like go to summer school voluntarily.
Yeah. That was not one of the things I did. I spent a lot of time just outside and roaming the forests.
Wow. Okay.
So I didn't retain a lot of the information I had learned from the previous year.
I had a lot of not. Are they Looney Tunes? Is Pepe Le Pew a Looney Tune?
Yes.
Okay. I had a lot of like Looney Tunes workbooks that I would do for fun.
Okay.
Yeah, the only time I remember going back to school and being like, oh my God, I have forgotten everything was, and it wasn't even that, it was my senior year of high school. I was in AP calculus for some reason, and I sat down the first day, and everybody before that had taken like AP pre-calc except for me. I got like signed into the class somehow without my knowledge. So everybody was like returning in. It was the same class, the same teacher. Everybody was comfortable with each other. They had little like songs or something that they use to remember things. So I sat down on that first day like, I don't know if I want to be in this class. I'm not that good at math. And they started talking about limits, and I have never in my life understood limits, and I never will. And they like jump right into it. They're like doing their little song, and I'm like, oh God, I do not belong here. I'm not smart enough for this. And then I dropped down to Calc Honors.
Well, that's how Harry and Ron feel.
Yeah.
In Transfiguration.
Yeah.
As Harry just chases a beetle around with his wand as it tries to escape off his desk. And Ron, who is clearly struggling with his wand, which is still broken and is just taped together. They say skello-tape.
Spello-tape.
Spello-tape?
Yeah.
Spello-tape makes more sense.
Yeah, than skello-tape. Spello-tape, actually, though, is a play on cello-tape, which is a popular brand of tape in Britain.
Is it like Scotch tape, though?
So I Googled that. I Googled pictures of cello tape, and they had both what we would call like packaging tape and then like little things of Scotch tape. So I'm not sure. Maybe we can find a British person to
maybe
email in or
brand.
Ask. It is a brand. Yes, it is a brand name, but it might be one of those things where like the brand name is synonymous with what it is, like Scotch tape.
Like Scotch tape. Yeah. Yes, that's the brand. I don't know what it actually is other than just Scotch tape.
Scotch tape is like the little tape.
I know exactly what Scotch tape is.
Yeah,
but like,
you don't
what is
know,
the name
yeah,
for it?
It's not little tape, but I have no idea. It's just Scotch tape.
Yeah.
Or like Band-Aid is kind of the same way. Although bandage is not that weird, but like, I feel like there's a different connotation for us to Band-Aid compared to bandage.
Yeah.
A bandage seems more serious.
I guess.
But anyway, yeah, cello tape and spello tape. It's a play on words there.
So this magical tape is not working well enough.
I don't think it's designed to repair wands.
No. And we say it's, or Harry sees that it's damaged beyond repair.
Yeah.
And all of his spells are not functioning correctly at all. And his wand is making weird noises. And Professor McGonagall does nothing about this. Like,
What is she going to do?
Make a comment at least, just like, hey, like, even if you knew what to do, you wouldn't be able to do it like this.
So this is my issue with this scene. Harry says to Ron, write home and ask for a new one, which I feel is quite insensitive, given that we've had three chapters that are just like, the Weasleys are poor. Look at how poor they are. And so Harry, having seen that firsthand, I feel like this is a little out of line to say that.
But it's not like Harry is able to buy him a wand either.
No, so,
but he knows that Ron can't make it through the year with this wand.
Yes, and that's fair. But like McGonagall knows the financial situation of the Weasleys, I'm sure. And so for her to come over and be like, you need a new wand, it just it puts Ron in a difficult situation. Having been a previous poor kid, it sucks when something breaks and you're worried about asking for a new one, even if it's something that you need.
Yeah. And the context of how it broke. Is a lot of
it's
why
a, it's a sore subject. It,
it's
as
the
well.
Main reason he's saying
that
oh,
Ron
I won't.
Says
yes.
I think there's more another to it, angle but, to this. Yeah, keep in mind too, it's also a hand-me-down wand.
Mm-hmm. So either way, he's struggling with magic because the wands that
it's super busted.
Yeah.
We also so they have a little break. They go to lunch and then are kind of hanging out before they have to go to Defense Against the Dark Arts. Before Herbology, Lockhart comes and like lectures Harry about like what a sad like Harry, come on, you can't just like
Harry,
fly cars into
Harry,
trees
Harry.
Every time you want to be on the newspaper.
Harry, Harry, Harry.
Yeah,
he says that a lot.
He does, yeah,
and like just talks over him the whole time. And it's clearly just, yes, I gave you, this is my fault. I'm so sorry. I gave you a taste of what real fame is.
And
you want more.
And this happens a little later, too, before the Defense Against the Dark Arts class. And Lockhart frames these little talks as like good-natured advice. And like he's acting as a mentor to Harry.
Yes.
When really, by the end of them, they always seem to end on this note of him emphasizing how much more famous and important he is than Harry. And again, it reeks of that like insecurity of somebody who really wants fame, that Lockhart knows deep down how famous Harry is and what a big deal Harry is. And I think in a way he's jealous of that, because no matter what he does and how many books he writes, he will never be as important as the person who defeated Voldemort as a baby.
And also, like, he's trying to say Harry's not really famous, and yet he knew who he was
the minute he saw him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that Lockhart is trying to insert himself into this so that he can, years down the line, be like, Harry,
I
taught him everything he knows.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so self-aggrandizing. It's so frustrating.
And that's why he's shoving his nose into everyone's business. He's looking to be like, I helped bandage up that Whomping Willow. Yeah. I helped Harry Potter. He's looking to take credit for everything.
Yeah. But we also meet Colin Creevy in this chapter. So while they're kind of relaxing before Defense Against the Dark Arts class, a little scrawny kid comes up to Harry with a camera, a muggle camera.
Spend some time staring at him.
Well, yeah,
just
as you do.
Staring.
And is asking Harry for a picture. And we learn that this is Colin Creevy,
who brought this camera from home. Mm-hmm. This is a regular muggle camera.
He is a muggle born. He says that his dad is a milkman.
Yep. And he's so excited to show a picture of Harry Potter to his dad, who clearly knows exactly who Harry Potter is as a milkman in the muggle world.
Well, I think that, like, we have only seen this situation from Harry's direct perspective at this point, of like realizing that you're magical and coming from a muggle family. In Harry's case, his muggle family doesn't want a thing to do with the magical world. But I have to imagine, as a parent, when you find out that your kid is magical and being shipped off to wizard school, you want to learn
more.
Yeah, a little bit about the magical world.
But I don't know if I found out there is a if I found out today there is a whole nother society that I've just been
ignorant of. Yeah.
Yeah. Completely unaware of. that I would get really into a random half celebrity. Like, at that point, it would almost seem fictional of like, well, so there was this big baddie who was going around killing a lot of people. And then this baby defeated him.
I think it's more.
And then I would just be infatuated with this baby.
I think it's more that Colin is so excited to be in this new world that, like, for him to see a celebrity that he's read so much about, he wants to bring that home and have proof to show, you know, like if you walk by a celebrity on the street.
Dad, but he's pitching it as it's for his dad is what I'm trying to say.
I think there's something sweet about that, though.
Yeah.
Because I think Colin is genuine in that. Like, compare that with Lockhart, who wants a picture with Harry so that they get on the front page of the Daily Prophet. Mm-hmm. I think Colin genuinely wants this picture because he's so excited to be here and so excited to meet someone famous. And he wants something to be able to tell people about it. Like, if you walked past a famous person on the street, you would want a picture with them so that when you tell people, I met whoever on the street, here's my picture. Here's my proof.
Yeah. And it's totally understandable. It was just it seems like he was trying to pitch it as this is for my dad.
I think that's genuine, though.
Okay.
Because something in me believes that he will mail this picture home to his dad.
100% if this picture ever got taken. It doesn't seem like he is in the picture. It seems like, well, for starters, he says, I want to take this picture with you. Maybe your friend can take it. And then a boy in my dormitory said, if I develop this film in the right potion, the pictures will move. Mm-hmm. It had not occurred to me
that it was a film camera.
That it was. No, it had not occurred to me that it was a potion with regular pictures.
It's possible that that's the process to make it. Like from a Muggle camera? I don't know. Maybe there are magic cameras where it's a different process, but I don't know.
It's possible there's multiple processes to do this where you have an enchanted camera in some way. And this is the way to just.
But it's also like if the Muggle world invents cameras, why wouldn't the Wizarding world just use like the existing technology? There's kind of.
Well, because they decided not to use light bulbs.
Oh, well, that's this kind of thing that Rowling does throughout the series of like the technologies that the Wizarding World chooses to adapt, which ones, and also they are very reluctant to adapt technology. And it's all this like older stuff, like the Weasley's cars from the 1950s. It's this weird thing. It's a quirk of the Wizarding World that they are reluctant to take these technologies. But I could see it being like, wow, the camera is really cool. Let's magicify that.
Yeah.
Some weirdo like Mr. Weasley figured out like, well, if we put the pictures in this potion, they'll move.
But I wonder if like this is just one way to do it with the regular cameras or if there's more.
Sure.
If there's like a magic camera as well.
Yeah. We'll have to wait for the Pottermore article on cameras.
So, yes, he says, and maybe you could sign it. So Malfoy comes along to make a big deal out of this. He's given out. Magic. He's giving out.
Malfoy's like Potter is giving out autographs now.
Yep. And only when it's brought up that signed photos are involved. Not that, Malfoy is causing a big stir or there's a fight about to happen. Lockhart hears
signed photos. He's got a Google alert for that.
I better come over here and sign some photos. They're looking for my signed photos, right?
I want to know what Draco was doing. Like, it seems that Draco is just like, did he really have nothing better to do than to go and find Harry and like make fun of him?
This seems like this is like a common area.
No, they were outside.
Yeah.
They were like out in the field.
They're not in some random field because some first year came up to them,
I guess.
And there was a crowd that formed very quickly. So that's like, this is like an open quad area kind of thing.
Maybe it was recess.
Not exactly.
Lockhart does come along and co-opts the photo op.
And says, we'll both sign the photograph.
Yeah.
So Colin, I don't think is in the photo.
No.
And it's just, he has a photo with Harry and Lockhart.
Yeah. I'm going to rewind a little and just talk about Colin's name because I have to. This is coming from Gladriel, author of The Ultimate Unofficial Guide to the Mysteries of Harry Potter. Creevy sounds like creepy.
Oh,
she wrote that.
Boy.
Yeah. I don't care for that. But she also says that it resembles
Colin. Sounds like coffin.
Oh, that's dark. Creve, she says, is a French word meaning break, and Latin crevi, C-R-E-V-I, is understand. No idea what any of that has to do with the character, but okay. And then Colin, the name, this I got from behindthename.com, comes from the Gaelic name Caelian, and I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, meaning whelp or young dog. And it also derives from Columba, which is a Latin name meaning dove.
Okay.
I think the Colin stuff is a little more meaningful than the stuff that Galadriel gave us, but that's Colin. So, like Joe said, Lockhart kind of takes things over and pulls Harry aside for another little chat. And this lasts all the way to the door to Defense Against the Dark Arts.
And then he like kind of holds him at the door for a little bit.
Yeah. And Harry does what any student would do in this situation, which is pick a desk in the very back and stack his books up so that Lockhart can't see him.
I liked part of this conversation is that Lockhart is saying, I just jumped in there so you didn't seem big-headed. You really shouldn't be giving out autographs. You know, when you get to my level, you'll have to go around with stacks of autograph pictures, but you aren't there yet.
He's the worst. So Lockhart opens up his Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson by talking about all his achievements. He does mention that he has Order of Merlin third class, which is a distinction that we've previously heard about with Dumbledore. But Dumbledore has Order of Merlin first class. So I did a little research. I found a Pottermore page about this. The first class distinction is given to people who do like an incredible act of bravery and will learn. Well, it was on Dumbledore's chocolate frog card, so we can say it was for defeating Grindelwald.
Was it for that? I could have sworn it was because of the discovery with the dragon blood. But that doesn't make if it was about bravery.
Bravery or like a transformative discovery.
Yeah, so I think it was the transformative discovery. Okay. I think it was the like eighth use of dragon blood that he discovered.
That sounds right. But the third class award is given for contributions in knowledge or entertainment. Yes. And okay. I think that's interesting wording for Lockhart.
It works in both ways.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So I think that's an interesting thing to pay attention to as we talk more about Lockhart. And then I have absolutely no notes for the actual Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson because I did not find it particularly compelling. I think because it's a scene that's like so played up in the movie that I'm just like, whatever. It's not worth talking about.
I don't get what his plan was.
For the pixies, I have no idea. He just like sets them loose and
he sets them loose and like doesn't tell them what to do beforehand or during.
Yeah.
He says, okay, deal with it, but only after a few minutes at least of them wreaking havoc. Because when he says, like, all right, do something about it, Neville is hanging from the ceiling by the time he says, all right, do something.
Yeah. This is, Joe and I are both teachers. This is a problem with the Hogwarts educational system that seemingly anyone can walk right up and have a job and they don't, there
it's
doesn't.
It's a private school.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Jeez. They don't need to have, say, a lesson plan or any kind of certifications or any kind of oversight that would maybe prevent this. If you walked in one day with a cage of pixies and somebody was like, and your principal said, like, can I see your lesson plan? You're expected to have something, you know, backed by standards and connected to assessment and I want to see the Lockhart lesson plan, but I know it doesn't exist because he opens the class by giving a test about himself and then ends it by just setting animals loose.
Magical animals that I see. What I'm thinking is, did he plan on releasing them?
Where because did he get them?
They were freshly caught. We don't get any more context.
Like, I can't imagine that he collaborated with Hagrid on this. Because
there's no way Hagrid's giving him.
Hagrid would have said, like, and what is the plan for these?
You know what?
Hagrid would have said it out of concern for the animal.
Hagrid would have given him the pixies.
He would have given them the pixies. But I feel like he would have enough awareness of, like, who Lockhart is to be like, you're going to treat these okay, right?
He trusts them.
You're not going to do anything horrible.
Books. Think about all the books that he's written about.
I don't know if Hagrid trusts him.
I'm sure, at least to start in their first conversation, Hagrid is willing to hand him some pixies for his Defense Against the Dark Arts class.
Okay.
Especially, it seems a lot like his plan was to keep them in the cage and just show them off.
He lets them out of the cage.
He lets them out of the cave after Seamus and Dean, I believe.
Yeah, they make fun of him.
Make fun of him.
Okay, so maybe it was like let's see.
Well,
then.
How about this? You don't think they're dangerous? Watch them destroy everything. And then he yells,
Pesky Petronomy. Yeah, more alliteration.
Which is the only way he knows
to deal with the pixies. And it does not work because a pixie takes his wand.
Nothing happens.
Oh, nothing happens?
Nothing
happens. Oh, in the movie, a pixie takes his wand.
It had absolutely no effect. One of the pixies seized his wands and threw it out the window, too. Okay. So after the fact.
Okay.
So he tries that one thing, and he can't say whether or not something else happened after that. And then he locks three students in the room to clean it up. Those yep. three students are the ones that sat in the back of the class.
Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
Yep.
It kind of surprises me that Hermione would sit in the back of the class with Harry and Ron.
She's willing to sit next to her friends.
Maybe she's embarrassed, too, about being close to Lockhart.
I feel like in every
other class, 100% of the time, Hermione is in the front row.
Most of the time, she is getting there before them, I'm sure. So she gets to pick the seat and they sit next to her.
Right.
But Harry sat down first this time.
Oh, okay. And that's the end of the chapter.
Well, the end of the chapter is
Hermione deals with the pixies.
Deals with the pixies, but while still defending him.
Yeah.
He just wants to give us some hands-on experience, which is what he says.
Mm-hmm.
He says, just nip the rest of them back in the cage. And then she immobilizes pixies with a freezing charm.
Which is more effective than Lockhart's attempts.
Which accomplished nothing.
Yes.
She also successfully managed to hold on to her wand the whole time.
Yeah.
While he did not.
Yeah. And that's the chapter. So that brings us to Spell of the Week.
Which is the freezing charm.
Huh. Funny surprise, how surprise. That works.
Well, they're always influenced by the chapter, and that yep. was the only spell, really, that works that we see.
Pesky pixie.
That works.
Petronomy.
That we see. So the freezing charm, the incantation is immobilis, and it stops the movement and actions of the target. It does not, like, turn them into ice cubes. It just, like, freezes them in place.
Okay. What is the distinction between this one and Petrificus Totalis?
Petrificus Totalis pins the limbs of the victim to their body. So this would just, like, stop them in place, the freezing charm, while Petrificus Totalis would pin them into a board, basically.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Immobilis, you could probably guess where that came from.
I don't know if I can.
Well, it immobilizes.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Some galaxy brain stuff that Rowling's on.
I don't know if the incantation is actually used in...
Hermione doesn't say it in this chapter.
She doesn't say it in this chapter. I don't know if it shows up in later books.
I don't know.
It is used in the movie. Oh, I like the note for this. Like, the first known use is Hermione Granger used this spell to successfully freeze a pair of pixies in her second year after her teacher tried and failed to subdue them using the nonsense incantation Pescapixie Pestronomy.
Yep.
I like that.
Cool.
A lot.
Is that Spell of the Week?
That is Spell of the Week.
Awesome. And so that is the end of our episode. We do not have any emails to talk about, but you can send us an email to owlpost@podtrificustotalis.com with your comments and corrections and truly anything you want to send us.
And just a heads up, we still have not released the first episode of this book as we're recording it. So
it's expected that we don't have emails to talk about right now.
So if you did send something in
before this episode came out, it was before we recorded it. So we haven't seen it yet because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. We may have to do... Instead of saying that at the end of every
episode,
we may do an email episode, a question episode. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Otherwise, you can subscribe to us on any of the major podcast platforms. Again, I'm not going to list them anymore. but if you find one that we're not on, like there's one specific app that you use that we don't seem to be on, just let us know either by email or like shoot us a message on Twitter or something and it'll get us on there. And yeah, you can follow us on Twitter at Podtrificus, and you can join us at our website, podtrificustotalis.com, for detailed show notes. There are some episodes with transcripts, references to all the stuff we've talked about, that kind of thing. And you can join us as well for Chapter 7,
Mudbloods and Murmurs.